This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Centuries ago, it wasn't unusual for someone to suffer from a vitamin deficiency from beriberi because there wasn't enough thiamine in their diet, or scurvy because of a lack of vitamin C, or pellagra because of a diet deficient in niacin. Our guest, Catherine Price, writes about the discovery of vitamins and their curative effects and how that has led to their overuse. Her book is Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. She writes that manufacturers have added vitamins to foods like donuts and sugary cereal, convincing the public that that makes them healthy. Catherine Price is a science journalist. She lives here in the Delaware Valley, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I have to say, I hadn't thought a lot about vitamins in the kind of chemical specificity of vitamins. But what's so fascinating is that there are 13 of them, and if we don't get them, we can die.
Yes, very serious.
And yet, only 13. I mean, it's just sort of fascinating to think how reliant we are on vitamins and how few there are.
Yes, and it's interesting to me that a lot of times when we use the word vitamin, we actually erroneously use the word to refer to a much broader category of dietary supplements. And that's basically all the stuff you can find in a GNC. That category has an estimated 85,000 products, whereas the actual vitamins are only 13. But if you go into your local drugstore and you look at the aisle that has the dietary supplements, you'll often see that the sign for the aisle says vitamins instead of dietary supplements. So I always like to clarify that. There's really only 13 A, C, D, E, K, and the 8 B vitamins, which go by other names like riboflavin or niacin or thiamine.
So how do vitamins work? And what's interesting, too, is that researchers don't entirely know the answer to that question.
Yeah, we don't fully understand how vitamins work or what they do in our bodies. We do know some of their functions. For example, vitamin C prevents scurvy, or vitamin D prevents the bone problem of rickets. But we don't fully understand how that occurs in many cases. And we also don't fully understand everything else that vitamins might do. So they're kind of a good example of how much is still understood about human nutrition overall.
You have some sections on scurvy. I mean, what it was like to have scurvy. I'll just read a couple of lines. Scurvy starts with lethargy so intense that people once believed laziness was a cause rather than a symptom of the disease. Your body feels weak, your joints ache, your arms and legs swell, and your skin bruises at the slightest touch. It gets worse here. As the disease progresses, your gums become spongy and your breath fetid. Your teeth loosen and internal hemorrhaging makes splotches on your skin. I didn't mean to read this whole paragraph here. Old wounds open, mucous membranes bleed. Left untreated, you will die, likely as the result of a sudden hemorrhage near your heart or brain. I mean, that is absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, scurvy's bad. And I think it's interesting because, at least for me, scurvy was the only vitamin deficiency disease I knew that much about when I first started researching this, which is to say I knew that vitamin C deficiency caused scurvy. And I thought that just had to do with your gums and like early explorers and, you know, their teeth. But it is pretty crazy, and it makes me think it reminds me of how lucky we are to not have to worry about these things much today. Because, for example, when I was in college, I remember Sunkissed Oranges was launching an ad campaign that involved a guy dressed up in a cape called Scurvy Boy.
Oh, no. Really?
Yeah. I guess he was giving out orange juice. But when you think about how horrible this disease actually was, the idea that you'd have like a mascot, you know, with a cape, is just it shows how far we've come in many ways. But it's good to remember how serious this can be.
In fact, it was a British sea captain who sort of helped to understand that, I guess, taking oranges along on his travels helped his crew.
Well, yeah, it was James Lind, and I believe it was lemons at that point. But Basically, there was one of the first controlled experiments. Many people say it was the first controlled experiment. Who knows if it's actually. But anyway, he wanted to see what was going on, if he could figure out something that might prevent or cure scurvy. So he actually did do an experiment with 14 sailors who had scurvy on his ship and gave them all sorts of different potential treatments, including things like seawater or this special thing that was a laxative, and then citrus fruit. And the men who got the citrus fruit recovered so well and so quickly that they actually were able to care for the other sailors. And he actually had very little of the fruit, so they didn't even get the full course of the treatment. That's how dramatic it was. But what's interesting about that is that he didn't immediately recognize that that was what had cured the sailors. And he's often credited for discovering the cause of scurvy. Mm. But in reality, there was still all this unknown. He wasn't really sure if that's what it was. He wrote like a 500-page treatise on the scurvy, as he called it. And that was buried in, I think, one sentence in the original text.
Also, I mean, while we're at it, let's talk a bit about pellagra. And and a physician named Joseph Goldberger who begins to, I guess, understand, first of all, what pellagra was about. Let's do the symptoms on that. Go ahead.
Well, pellagra, yes, niacin deficiency. And that, oh, God, I just keep thinking of this picture, if anyone wants to Google pellagra, of this poor guy with his arms crossed over his chest with this horrible scaly rash all over them. And, pellagra will also kill you. It was a big problem in the American South up through the 30s, which is when Goldberger was doing his work. And
in institutions, right?
Yeah, a lot of it was institutions that had niacin poor diets. And yeah, but that was also the day before informed consent, so he could, you know, use orphans, prisoners, whoever he wanted, he could use. But anyway, it causes dermatitis, that rash, diarrhea, dementia, and death. It was known as the disease of the four Ds. And this, as I said, was a huge problem in the American South. What's crazy is this was even once vitamin deficiency diseases had been recognized, and vitamins themselves had also been recognized, which was a process that took a very long time. But people were very resistant, kept thinking it was a bacterial disease. And Goldberger actually died of cancer before anyone officially recognized.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that it could be treated with niacin, which actually was a photographic chemical that had been in use since, I believe, 1867. It was called nicotinic acid. And later, bread manufacturers lobbied to have that name changed to niacin because it sounded too much like nicotine.
He had these things. He called them filth parties. I mean, this was one of the ways that I guess he was trying to diagnose what was going on.
Yes. And this, by the way, is one of the things I really like about you, Marty, is that you picked up on all the gross parts and you're enjoying asking about them.
Of course. Of course.
I never get to talk about filth parties. Yeah. So he was so convinced that that this was not an infectious disease because Goldberger had done a lot of work with infectious diseases. He'd seen the results and this didn't seem to resemble them to him. Also, he spent a lot of time with people with pellagra and he wasn't getting sick. So he decided to throw what he called filth parties. Truly disgusting events where he and a group of his medical colleagues, one wonders if they volunteered or if they were volunteered, I don't know which, would get together and they would inject themselves with blood from some of the patients with pellagra. Or I think more disgustingly, they would take bodily secretions or like dried skin flakes from these people, put them into little pills and then eat them. And that this was done to prove that they would not get pellagra. It's not transmissible by you know, the way the bacterial infection would be. And his wife, Mary, actually wanted to partake in this, but they wouldn't let her do it. She wasn't allowed to eat the skin
flakes. Someone had to
have their
senses, right?
I know, right? But she did manage to get injected with blood. And the nurse who was watching this burst into tears because she thought this was a suicidal act. But needless to say, none of them got pellagra, and it is a vitamin deficiency disease.
Also, what's interesting, we will move on from the more disgusting parts of this hour, but even small amounts of vitamin A, I mean, when there were, and there still are, true deficiencies, small amounts of vitamin A are incredibly, not just restorative, but curative.
Yes, vitamin A is a really great current example of the really miraculous powers of vitamins when they are administered in cases of true deficiency. So we need vitamin A for a number of reasons, again, not all of which are fully understood. But one of the main ones is to allow us to see at night because vitamin A is very important for the functioning of the cells in our eyes that are responsible for night vision. That used to be what people really thought vitamin A was for. But in the 20s and 30s, and then later in the 80s and 90s, it was discovered and then rediscovered that vitamin A plays an enormously important role in our immune systems. And that night blindness, as the sight condition is called, is a sign of late stage vitamin A deficiency. Right. And that if you don't correct it, then you're highly likely to die. This is causing something like 250 to 500,000 kids around the world to go blind every year now. And one estimate I heard is that up to 90% of those kids might die from it. But you can prevent this and possibly cure it by just giving twice yearly doses of vitamin
A.
Yeah. Yearly by capsule. You just basically squirt a capsule of vitamin A in a kid's mouth twice a year and they will not have this problem. And if they're starting to lose their sight and you do this, they can get their vision back within days. So it's really pretty amazing. But I should note, don't take vitamin A because you think it's good for your immune system because it only is important if you're deficient and it can be toxic.
Indeed. And yeah. Let me just sort of move on with some of this history. So it seems, especially focusing on this country, is that about 100 years ago or so, it was really just the important role that vitamins played in our diet. I mean, it seemed to be people accepted that. But then it seemed to get, as the century wore on, especially around World War II, then the sort of obsession took hold. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, first I would just emphasize how crazy I at least thought it was that they really were only discovered about 100 years or accepted. The word vitamin was coined in 1911, and that was before any vitamin actually had been chemically isolated. That didn't occur till 1926 with thiamine. So they're really surprisingly recent in terms of our understanding of them. But as you're saying, what started off as this scientific discovery, truly a breakthrough in medicine and in science, began to be transferred over to the public in a really interesting way, where you had some nutritional biochemists actually writing columns in popular magazines for the public. And you also had food advertisers and marketers start to pick up on the fact that, you know, in the 20s, that there were these tasteless, invisible, essential things in food that no one could measure. So if you could figure out that your food contained some of this substance, it was a great marketing ploy. And then, as you're saying, in the 40s, the government itself began to become concerned that there weren't that people in the United States were suffering from hidden hunger, which is basically having enough calories but not having enough micronutrients. And they worried that American soldiers would not be prepared enough to fight World War II and the American public would not have enough morale, or as they put it, oomph or zest or pep to
very
keep their
40s
spirits
words.
Exactly, very 40s words, and totally not a concern in World War II if you want a peppy public, right? Like that was – there was a lot of energy there. But anyway, they were very concerned about this and yeah, I mean, you can kind of see this obsession begin to spread from the food scientists to the marketers to the government to the public, and that's continued today.
Is it fear-based? I mean, was it if you don't get enough of these vitamins, then you will pay the health consequences?
Yes. So originally it was very much fear-based, and that still drives a lot of that today. I think that if you had to summarize our obsession with vitamins in two words, it would be fear and hope. So, you know, you have this fear of this deficiency. In the 20s, when these articles were written for the public, as I mentioned, there was a lot of things like, you know, this housewife, you're a housewife and you don't get your family enough vitamins and you're playing Russian roulette with their health and, you know, they might die and horrible things will happen. And they'd use very dramatic examples, maybe reading them that scurvy paragraph you
sure.
read. When in reality, most Americans were not, I mean, pretty much no one was suffering from that level of scurvy. So the fear was a bit amplified. And then you also have the hope that if vitamins can do miracles in cases of deficiency, then they can do something even more astounding if you take more of them.
The idea is that more is better.
Yeah.
More is better when it comes to vitamins. I do want to take a very short break, and we will dispel that myth after this very short break. Catherine Price is our guest, and she's got a new book. It's called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection, talking about our evolving understanding of vitamins. She's a science writer based here in the Philadelphia area. We're going to take a very short break. You can send us an email, any questions or comments you might have, and that phone number, email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Most Americans get plenty of A, C, D, E, K, and the B vitamins, but that doesn't stop some people from taking extra nutritional supplements, extra vitamins, in hopes that they will give them more energy, boost their IQ, and even keep cancer at bay. We seem to believe that if small amounts of vitamins are good for us, then taking a lot more is a lot better. That is not the case, says our guest, Catherine Price, in her new book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. So why isn't, you know, unlimited amounts of vitamin A, B, C good for us?
Well, a variety of reasons depending on the vitamin. I mean, in general, I think it's dangerous to assume that that idea is dangerous in general. I mean, if you have a need for water, or, you know, which we all do, obviously, that's one thing. But if you were to drink 16 gallons a day, you could kill yourself. So even things that are absolutely essential in certain amounts are not safe at high doses. If you get into particular vitamins, you have cases where high levels will lead to acute toxicity. Like I was mentioning with vitamin A, can cause liver damage. But you also have issues where we just don't know what the long-term effects are of really high doses. So if you take vitamin C, for example, which a lot of people do take in very high doses, and they think it's safe because it is excreted readily in your urine, which is true, we just don't know what would happen if you were to saturate your body with vitamin C every day for years. Mm. It's very hard to study these things. There's not really a financial incentive to do so because vitamins can't be, you know, you can't make money really off of a vitamin as a prescription drug. So I would just be hesitant to think that any of these chemicals, which clearly are doing things in our bodies, they're very important. They're staving
Indeed.
Off diseases. You
Indeed.
Know, if they're doing something in our bodies in a small amount and we don't really know what they do in a high amount, then I am hesitant to take them in a high amount. And there have been studies, such as beta carotene, which is a precursor to A, where people found that high doses of beta carotene, for example, over a couple of years actually greatly increased the risk of lung cancer, particularly in smokers, so much so that one of the big studies was stopped early. And that was particularly crazy because the hypothesis was that beta carotene should help prevent cancer, especially in smokers. So, you know, I just think that people should be careful.
If you have a balanced diet, and not everybody does, but if you eat a balanced diet, can you assume that you are getting all your vitamins?
Well, that, of course, depends on how we define balanced diet,
Indeed.
Right? So that's an interesting term. Obviously, it's controversial because every couple of years, the USDA comes up with a new definition of what that is.
That food pyramid,
The food
right?
pyramid, or what was it? Yeah, they've got all sorts of things. I remember when the food pyramid was divided with like lines down the middle. It just made absolutely no sense. but anyway, I would say that if you are eating a lot of foods that are naturally nutrient dense, so if you're eating produce, if you're eating minimally processed meats and dairy and fatty fish and things like that, yeah, you're probably fine with vitamins. And you're also, importantly, getting a lot of other stuff that's in these foods that aren't vitamins. But you also could be eating a diet that's high in refined and processed foods like breakfast cereals, breads, I don't know, even sports drinks, stuff that has synthetic vitamins added to it. I wouldn't recommend that as a diet in general because I think there's many things that are not healthy about it, one of which is that would not contain the other substances that the natural foods would. But if you're just talking about the 13 vitamins, you're probably fine because there's so many of them added. But on the flip side, the danger of that is that you might think, oh, I'm fine with vitamins, so this is a healthy diet, when in fact it's really not. You're just covering one of your bases.
Does your body know if it's synthetic vitamins versus vitamins that might come from eating kale, let's say, for instance?
It depends on the vitamin and the circumstance. There are certain vitamins that are easier to absorb in natural foods. There are certain ones that are easier to absorb as the synthetic form. For example, folic acid is synthetic folate. That's vitamin B9, important for preventing birth defects. And our bodies absorb the folic acid better than the folate. And the other thing is that there might be synergies in the way that vitamins work when they're found in foods that naturally contain them. So if you have an orange and you're interested in vitamin C, well, there's lots of other stuff in an orange besides vitamin C. And we don't know how that other stuff is affecting the vitamin C, how the vitamin C is affecting the other stuff, or how the other stuff is working with the other stuff.
all the stuff that we eat.
Yeah.
One of the things that you seem to be saying is, in this book, is that by adding vitamins to, you know, cereals and breads and perhaps even some of the, you know, fast food products, we have convinced ourselves or been convinced that we are getting our vitamins. Your book is called Vitamania. I mean, is there a kind of obsession about having enough vitamins in our diet?
I think that there is. And I also would say, though, that this has transcended vitamins. And this gets to the point we were talking about earlier about how people often conflate vitamins and dietary supplements. So back in the 30s, 40s, it really was vitamins that people were obsessed with. Today, people still are, I think, obsessed with vitamins in the sense that we feel it's our obligation to take a multivitamin or to give our kids a Flintstone, stuff like that. But I think that vitamins, it's such a captivating word. It's based on the Latin word for health.
Right.
Or life, sorry. And that basically has opened the door for a faith in all of these other substances that are captured under or referred to under the umbrella of the term vitamin. So now you won't necessarily see vitamins being touted, although you do. You still do, like vitamin D in cocoa pebbles, which is just, I laugh every time I think of that.
In the cereal cocoa pebbles?
Yeah exactly. It's
chock
great.
Full of vitamin D?
Exactly. It's a healthy choice for you and your family. But but now you see all these other ingredients, whether they're chemicals that are added to things like sports drinks or whether it's specific ingredients, like, for example, chia seeds, very hot right now, or hemp products. But basically these isolated chemicals or ingredients that we've decided are quote-unquote superfoods or nutraceuticals is another word for it. So to answer your question, yes, still very interested in vitamins, but that has also expanded into this vitamin-influenced obsession with the idea that there are magic bullets in our food.
You described going to, I guess it was a GNC. You were looking for something. What were you looking for?
Well, I have very dry skin. I didn't used to have this problem, but I've developed sensitive skin, and I was just trying to see if I could find anything in the supplement store that might help, because I'd gone to a lot of doctors. I tried a lot of different things, you know, prescription steroid creams and stuff, which are not good to use over long periods of time. And I thought, well, I mean, all these other people go to GNC or places mm-hmm. like it to try to find something quote unquote natural to treat it. I might as well try. And I mean, that gets to the hope thing we were talking about earlier, that Western medicine had not been able to treat this. And so why not see if there's an alternative?
And you were told to buy something called buckthorn.
Yes.
Or that was a suggestion from the person working at the GNC.
Sea buckthorn, which is omega-7 fatty acids. It's interesting because that was a couple years ago. And since then, sea buckthorn has become one of those things that has been popping up more and more places. Because I'd never heard of it. And now I see it everywhere. But yet the clerk recommended I try sea buckthorn mm-hmm. oil. Interestingly, the clerks are not supposed to, you know, prescribe a supplement for specific conditions. It's a very tricky line where they're supposed to sell the supplements, but technically, I mean, that's medical advice, right? So, but anyway, she did recommend this. And
did it work?
No.
No.
It did not work.
What is in sea buckthorn? I mean, as you investigated this, what is it, a topical, I guess?
This was capsules.
Oh,
it's
capsules.
Very difficult to tell exactly what was in the sea buckthorn capsules, because first of all, the label didn't specify what type of the sea buckthorn oil it was. But second, it's just in general very hard to tell what is in supplements, because there are a lot of cases where what it says on the label is not actually what's in the bottle. So I basically made my decision based on the marketing on the boxes that I looked at.
Well, what you did was a while ago. More recently, the New York Attorney General's office, you know, going after GNC and a couple of other retailers, Target, Walgreens, Walmart, for their supplements and mislabeling them, or even having kind of bogus labels, because what was in the bottle was not what was on the label.
Yes, this was it came out in February. The Attorney General had done a bunch of testing on herbal supplements. This was just on herbals, actually,
right.
And had supposedly found that a lot of the products did not contain any of what they said they did. The supplement industry has been pushing back and saying they should have used a different kind of testing. And as far as I know, the Attorney General has not yet released the full report, so it's hard to get to the bottom of that particular issue. But the broader point is that herbal supplements, as well as many other supplements, pretty much every category of supplement, has been found to have problems, either with not containing what it says, containing what it says in different amounts from what it says, or being spiked with things it should not be. For example, a Chinese herbal supplement actually having Viagra in it.
Wow.
Or in 2010, the head of the FDA wrote a letter to the supplement industry talking about how there'd been all sorts of things like anticoagulants and convulsants and antidepressants, all sorts of stuff found in supplements, which clearly they should not be. And that can cause major problems if you're actually taking a prescription or a legal drug without realizing that you are.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Catherine Price. She's a science writer, and she's also the author of a new book called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Send us an email. Any questions or comments you might have, that address, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You mentioned the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. You also include in this book, and this is, it's been written about before, in 1976, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was passed. A couple of years later, in 1994, the Dietary Health and Education Act of 1994, both of them basically saying to the FDA, hands off when it comes to things like, I guess, what, cosmetics and supplements?
Well, the 76 one was actually the Proxmire Amendment, or the Vitamin Mineral Amendment. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was originally 1938.
Okay.
But yes, so the 1976 Act basically forbade the FDA from ever setting limits on the amount of a vitamin that could be or mineral that could be put into a supplement, and also made it impossible for the FDA to ban ingredients that were known to be useless or to set standards for products, meaning that if you say that your product is a multivitamin, it has to contain X, Y, and Z in these quantities. You can see the results of that if you actually look at the ingredients or the nutrition facts, supplement facts panels on multivitamins in your drugstore. Right. You'll see that they actually have different combinations of ingredients, often in different levels. So, for example, gummies, which adults love as well as children.
We're talking gummy, like
gummy vitamins.
Gummy vitamins.
I mean, they taste just like gummy bears, to which sure. I say, like, eat gummy bears and then take a multivitamin if you're doing that, because it's really tempting to eat the whole bottle, and that's a bad idea. But anyway, those have different combinations of vitamins than a chewable or a swallowable capsule. Wow. Yeah. And then 1994 was DSHE, the Dietary Health and Education Act, Supplement and Education Act. And that was a huge deal that was sponsored by industry, pretty much written by industry. And that took away a lot of the FDA's authority to actually require, actually it took away all the authority of the FDA to require supplement makers to prove that their products were safe or effective before selling them. So now it's entirely on the FDA to come in after the fact and try to prove that a particular supplement or vitamin product is dangerous once it's actually already started to harm consumers. And it's so difficult to do this that there's only been one dietary ingredient banned since the passage of the 1994
Act. Which one was that?
Ephedra.
Oh, ephedra,
yeah.
Sure.
So
sure.
A stimulant. But I should note, I mean, just on April 7th, there was an article in the Times about how there's a new chemical, BMPEA, that's nearly identical to amphetamine. And that has been found in a number of products, weight loss and sports products that are currently on the market. It's been banned in Canada. We're not doing anything about it here. And it's very dangerous.
Why do they want to tie the hands of the FDA?
Well, it's really expensive to require lots of testing for safety and efficacy. If you look at prescription drugs, I should point out, I'm not arguing that supplements should be regulated in that as stringently as prescription drugs. But if you do look at that, it costs billions with a B of dollars to get one of those approved. And it can take an average of 12 years. So would you want to have that process? Or would you want to have a process where I could actually go home after this interview, put a couple of things in my kitchen into a bottle and sell it on the internet? Right.
I mean, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
something
yeah.
that kind of willy nilly.
Yeah. Like, I mean, obviously, there are also big companies making reputable products, but there's nothing stopping me from doing that. And then the FDA would have to find my product, prove that it was dangerous, and then go after me.
We've done shows similar to this before, and some of the critical comments is, well, you know, look at the FDA, look at, you know, pharmaceuticals that have been dangerous. They've gone through all the testing and they've ended up hurting people or maybe gotten withdrawn from the market. Look at all the advertising on TV and all the, you know, yes, they have all the caveats at the end, but the pictures, you know, the pictures look very inviting.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to that?
Well, yeah, I think America's over-medicated, and I think there's lots of issues with the pharmaceutical industry. And we're the only country besides New Zealand that can do direct-to-consumer advertising. And that was a really, I don't know, don't keep my language clean, but I think that's really weird that we can do that. So I definitely personally have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. But I would say when you find a problem with a pharmaceutical drug once it's on the market, you at least know that someone tried to find the problems beforehand. If you've got supplements, no one even had that first level of screening, right? So if you're still finding problems in a process that takes 12 years and billions of research dollars, that makes me very nervous about products for which there's no such requirements.
Because you need, what, a double-blind study? I mean, and in order to prove efficacy, you need to be able to do some pretty rigorous testing.
Yeah, for FDA, it's a multi-phase process starting with animals and then working up to small groups of humans and then bigger groups of humans and then following up after the drug is approved to try to make sure that it does what they say and that it's not going to have adverse events. And as I just mentioned, importantly, there is a follow-up afterwards. So that's how they're catching these things that are problems after the drug's approved. So there are strict requirements for pharmaceutical drugs. And I have seen statements from the supplement industry saying that if you had these same standards for mm-hmm. supplements, the supplement industry just wouldn't exist.
There just isn't the money, I guess.
Well, it's a $36 billion a year industry. It's not like this is, you know, right. This is someone once said old hippies in their backyards, like growing echinacea, right? This is like a big business. But I mean, how would you
How would you sell these products if it turned out that they weren't effective or that they had safety concerns? I mean, it just wouldn't really make sense as a business.
Let me just quote something from your book. One of the best-known examples of the dangers of our unquestioning faith in the safety of supplements is St. John's wort. How so?
Yes, and that, again, is a supplement, not a vitamin, but yes. It's one of the most popular herbal treatments for depression. And it does have an active ingredient that could be useful for depression. But the fact that it has an active ingredient means that it actually interferes with a lot of other prescription drugs. One estimate I heard was over 50% of prescription drugs actually are affected by St. John's wort. And that's because of the effect of St. John's wort in a particular enzyme in your liver that's responsible for how you metabolize, meaning break down and absorb drugs. So some of the potential interactions include interactions with other antidepressant medicines, kind of ironic, interactions with organ transplant drugs. So there have been problems where people have had a transplanted kidney, for example, and then had the organ rejected because St. John's wort interfered with that organ through the anti-rejection drug. Or birth control. So I heard someone talk about how there are a lot of quote-unquote miracle babies associated with the use of St. John's wort because you think, oh, I've been so rigorous in taking my birth control every day, but now I'm pregnant. And guess why? That's because
it's the interaction between St. John's wort.
Yeah, or the St. John's wort affects this enzyme in your liver that means that you break down the birth control medicine too quickly. You don't actually absorb enough of the active medication, and then it's not effective. So that's a great example, I think, of how careful you need to be. But the supplement industry does not want to put a warning label on St. John's wort. What they say in response to that question, I mean, if you know these interactions, why don't you say it somewhere really obvious, right? Is that on the back? It says it should not be used without the advice of your doctor, and especially women who are pregnant should talk to their doctor. Well, great. I mean, that's like every...
But do doctors know?
Doctors might not know, first of all. And how many people really look at that generic line and say, ah, yes, I have to go consult with my doctor? And a lot of people lie to their doctor about what supplements they take. So I personally don't find that to be a very satisfying argument.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Catherine Price, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's a science writer. She's written for a number of publications, and she's written a new book. It's called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Let me open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499 for your questions or comments. This note, Catherine Price is not a doctor, so we cannot be prescribing on the air. You can send us an email, radiotimes at WHYY.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and I'm talking with Catherine Price about her new book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. And to join the conversation, and again, more generic calls or questions, if I can put it that way, rather than specific ones about what you should do about your health, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyy Radio Times. In fact, we have a tweet from Colin. He wants to know, any differences in vitamin needs for different races? He says, aside from vitamin D, but let's talk a little bit about vitamin D.
Sure. Yeah. So that's an interesting question that I don't think we fully know the answer to blatantly disregard his thing about vitamin D, just as an example. It's commonly thought that people who have darker skin require more vitamin D than people with lighter skin because vitamin D is produced in our skin with the help of sunlight, and the pigment in darker skin blocks some of that reaction. Interestingly, there was a recent study in Baltimore where they had African-American and Caucasian men studying the vitamin D requirements of these people. And it turned out that even though the African-American men were getting less vitamin D in their skin in response to sun, they actually had stronger bones and teeth than white counterparts, which is one of the main roles of vitamin D is helping to incorporate calcium into your bones. So that was totally counterintuitive and opens the question, well, is it that they're using the D more efficiently or they have lower requirements? We don't know. But to get into a different area, that just kind of points out the amount of variability there can be between specific people. I mean, not even at a race level, like between me and Marty, we could have different requirements. And personal requirements fluctuate at different times of year. There's a lot of variability, and it's really impossible to get a recommendation that would be applicable to everyone in a population. And the RDA should not be taken to mean that.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the RDA, which you do write about. And often, you know, you look and it says 100% or whatever it is. You're saying don't rely on that as if it's sort of gospel.
Yeah, it's not gospel. I mean, I used to spend a lot of my high school mornings reading the back of the Total Cereal box and feeling really satisfied with myself, even though I hated Total Cereal.
You'd rather have that Count Chocula,
yeah,
right?
No, I don't. Thankfully, I don't think I ever wanted that either. But now I know if I need more D, I could just eat that. No, but the most important thing I would say is that the 100% you're looking at on the back of that label, it's actually based on recommendations from 1968. And a lot of those recommendations have changed since then. So if you are feeling really self-satisfied with yourself, just be aware that you're actually not scoring as well as you think. You may be overscoring in certain vitamins or underscoring in others. With that said, to emphasize again, the RDAs are meant as a population thing. So it's basically meant to make sure, say if you're designing a school lunch program, that 98% of the kids who eat that program will have will have their vitamin needs met. So the analogy I use is like a sweater. If the government was trying to knit a sweater that was going to cover be big enough for any particular person, or 97 to 98 out of every 100 people in the United States, you'd have a pretty big sweater because we come in a lot of different sizes. But if you are, you know, 5 feet and 100 pounds, you're not going to need a sweater that big. Similarly, the RDA will cover 97 to 98 out of 100 people's supposed vitamin needs, but a lot of people need less than that. So they really shouldn't be taken as gospel or as personal advice.
Well, and is it the bigger you are, the more vitamins you need, or does it work that way? Or,
not necessarily. I mean, obesity is correlated with higher needs for certain vitamins or a less efficient usage of them. In some cases, because some of the fat-soluble vitamins can get stored in fat tissue and are less accessible. But yeah, not necessarily. I mean, you can have, like, a smoker will need more vitamin C. You know, in the winter, most of us have less vitamin D. Alcoholics might have a thiamine deficiency. I mean, it really can vary.
We talked about, you know, some of the really sort of horrible symptoms of having a vitamin deficiency. How common is that in the U.S. today? I mean, is this an issue of vitamin deficiency? I'm sure it is in developing parts of the world, but in the United States today.
In the United States, we're lucky in that we don't have that many cases of frank, outright vitamin deficiency diseases. You're not going to see mass outbreaks of scurvy. Pellagra is something that most people have never heard about these days. Beriberi, thiamine deficiency, killed tons of people in the 1870s or in the 1800s. Not a problem. You do have some people who still manage to be deficient in vitamins, even though so much of our food is fortified with synthetic versions. Again, most of the time they're not going to have their teeth falling out, but you can have moderate deficiencies. So I think that, you know, we're lucky in that we have such easy access to cheap synthetic vitamins, whether it's the fortified stuff in foods or the stuff we're taking in multivitamins. Very few of us are really, really, really deficient in vitamins. With that said, that should not give us an excuse to pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, our diets are so fantastic, because they are not.
Well, indeed. We were talking before going on the air about cases of rickets in this country, though.
Yeah, there have been occasional cases of rickets in America and Great Britain. I mean, it's certainly a problem in India, for example, in slums among kids, like an actual big problem. But there have been cases, and that's partially because we cover ourselves up so much in the sun. We've taken the advice to use sunscreen. Also, most of those cases have been in babies or infants, and that is because very little vitamin D is passed through breast milk. It's actually found in very few foods. The D in cow milk is a synthetic addition. So there can be cases where babies can become deficient and start showing signs of rickets that still exist.
Let me get to some of our callers. It looks like we have Henrietta calling us from Reading. Hi, Henrietta. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to make a plug for all the conscientious health food store owners and people who select very carefully what sort of supplements that they offer their customers. And actually point that not against but aside from GNC stores and mass stores that have a great marketing campaign and have obviously a profit margin that they're dealing with. These are franchises versus individual people who have stores who do it for the reason of benefiting the public.
And Henrietta, are you one of those store owners?
I'm a naturopathic doctor, actually.
Okay.
And I do shop with people and have for many years who I know where to go to ask the right questions.
Yeah, well, let me give Catherine a chance to weigh in.
Yeah, I think it's great that you're doing the research and trying to shop with really conscientious people. I guess my response would be that, well, first of all, it's a good point, and I would like to think there'd be people I could find that I could trust. But it does concern me that even those conscientious people don't necessarily have great ways of telling that what they're selling actually is what they think it is, which is really scary when you think of it, because if you have a herbal supplement, it's a long chain of ingredients, and you could have problems anywhere along the way. And just to give an example, in 2014, when the FDA did inspections of supplement manufacturers, 62% of those manufacturers received letters of noncompliance from the FDA, meaning they had some problem where the most common problems were they didn't test the supplement ingredients to see if they were what they said, or they didn't have standards in place to actually define mm-hmm. what their products were. So again, not to say that there are not conscientious supplement sellers out there. There certainly are, but there's just so many opportunities for bad things to happen that it makes me nervous.
Catherine, does that give you pause at all?
It definitely gives me pause. You know, I wish I felt more comfortable with some of the alternative treatments out there. But the fact that it's so hard to tell if they're actually effective, and then if they were effective, to know what dose, and then if you figure that out, to actually know which products to take, I mean, it's nearly impossible from a consumer perspective. And that's what I find frustrating.
Henrietta, do you want to weigh in on that at all? Henrietta?
Just a little. Yes, I'd like to. Thank you, Marty. Just sure. In terms of education, I mean, I've been in this business for close to 30 years, and for me, it's always been an issue of education. People make assumptions based on, oh, I have to get this, and it must be natural, therefore it's safe. That is by far not a safe approach. Mm. So you really want to go and actually take a good look at what it is that you're dealing with, speak to other people and educate yourselves. I see with all these supplement offers and everything that for the most part, they're still looking at it as if it was one size fits all. And that, like you just discussed a minute ago, really does not work. So it is the education of the person themselves. And personally, for me, my clients in my practice, I work with a lot of food-based things and herbal things. So much less than, and I never use synthetic supplements if I can avoid it.
Well, you know, I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Catherine. Looks like you want to add something.
Oh, I was just going to follow up on Henrietta's point and say that it is very important for people to become educated, and just to recommend a few resources. So there's a NIH Herbs at a Glance database that gives some research about various herbs that people commonly use, about the effectiveness and the possible side effects. You also can look for seals that are signs that a third-party company has evaluated the supplement to see if it contains what it claims. Not about safety and efficacy, but at least to see if it contains the right ingredients. So NSF and USP are two of those. And then one of my favorites is ConsumerLab.com, which is a subscription-based site, I think totally worth it if you're taking a lot of supplements, that actually pulls products off store shelves and tests them to make sure they have what they say, and also has a really good database of scientific evidence for and against each of these supplements. So those are possible resources for people.
Henrietta, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I think just for the general public, you'll read, you know, a news story with a flashy headline. Whether it's, you know, a vitamin or a pharmaceutical or some of the things that we have been talking about, and you feel like, aha, you know, this is the elixir, this is the thing that's going to solve my problem. There's a lot of that in terms of science journalism.
There is, and as a science journalist, I always feel the
that's
need
why
to,
I asked you, yes.
I always feel the need to point out that the motivations of scientists and journalists are not the same, or I should say editors, or at least I try not to do this. But, you know, the role of a scientist is to find scientific answers. Science takes a really long time, and you will come up with multiple hypotheses, many of which are contradictory, that seem like they're right, and then they'll be contradicted by the next things. It just takes a long time to figure out the truth, as happened with the history of vitamins. Editors for magazines or newspapers, their job is to have news, right? So they are going to report on each of these studies. And even though they'll always have a caveat in there that more research is needed, or this is, you know, inconclusive because of X, Y, and Z, the public is not going to take it that way. No. Because nutrition in particular is something we want to take the news and apply directly to our lives in a way that many other areas of science are not. You know, fuel cells, for example. I mean, you're not going to have that big of an effect on what you eat for breakfast. But if you find a big story about vitamin D, then it might affect what you have for breakfast. So I just like to caution people against taking the latest headline and using that to decide what they're going to eat. And instead doing, if you're going to try to do that, do research about how conclusive that study was, how big it was. The Harvard School of Public Health has a great set of articles about how you can evaluate a news story to see how conclusive it is, and I recommend people check that out. But it's very confusing and really a problem.
What got you into this? I mean, what got you interested in vitamins, or as your book is called, Vitamania, which was actually a phrase from the 1940s, right?
Yes, it was coined by a journalist in 1942, I believe, named Robert Yoder, in a very funny article that I quote in some places in the book. But yes, Vitamania. I became interested in one sense because my husband asked me one day what a vitamin was, and I didn't have a good answer.
As a science writer yourself.
Exactly.
Right?
And I also have type 1 diabetes, so I think about food all the time, I mean, in terms of its chemical composition. But in general, I'm just fascinated by things that we think we understand that are around us all the time, and then which, if we actually think about it, we realize we don't know anything about. And that was the case for me in vitamins, and I think is the case for many of us with vitamins. Because as I said before, I just thought vitamins, vitamin C, scurvy, explorers, leaf, Erickson or whatever, and like teeth. That was it. No idea, but I'd taken Flintstones through all my childhood, so that's what got me into it. And then it just expanded and expanded, and ended up with.
And here you are with a
book. I am.
Let me get. Looks like Sheila from South Jersey to join our conversation. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Great conversation. I've been very mindful as well about what I put in my body. So it's always been a question in my mind: how does one synthesize? In a lab, I suppose, these vitamins, they're chemicals as opposed to something found in nature. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure.
Thanks, Sheila.
The first thing I would say is that the forms found in nature are also chemicals. So it's important to remember that, because I think we tend to create this divide between natural and man-made and call one a chemical and one not a chemical. But they're all chemicals. I mean, everything around us is a chemical. So just to point that out as a starting point. In terms of how you make the synthetic versions, it depends on the vitamin. Some of them are synthesized with chemical reactions in a lab, like vitamin C, for example. Some of them are actually made by bacteria. So if you look at vitamin B12, it's a very complex molecule. It was only truly synthesized in the 70s. That's how recent. I actually talked to a guy who was one of the – he almost was credited with discovering it. I mean, he's still alive. This is in the 40s. So anyway, so we technically know how to make B12, but it's so complicated, it's a lot easier to just get bacteria to do the job for us. So in the case of B12 and niacin, there's bacterial – fermentation, I mean, the processes that make those. And then there's some that are just kind of, I think, interesting in a different way. Like vitamin D is primarily made by irradiating lanolin. And lanolin is the grease that's found on sheep wool. So if you look at a lot of vitamin D supplements, they'll say, you know, it comes from pure lanolin, which is true. But I just think it's funny that if you actually look into that, it's from sheep grease. Again, nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's the same process in the lanolin that happens in our skin. But it certainly was not what I would have thought, you know.
Do you still read the backs of cereal boxes looking at all the ingredients? And the reason I ask is whether we have either too much information or we're too sort of obsessed about vitamins and supplements and minerals and all of that.
Well, I don't eat cereal. So that's the first thing. I mean, I got diagnosed with type 1 when I was 22, so breakfast cereal in general is like a disaster for me. But I do... I'm surprised I haven't gotten stopped in the supermarket, because I'll walk up and down the aisles like taking pictures of things and then reading the backs of the boxes and getting these weird looks from clerks. But I do think we get too obsessed with trying to turn all these foods into math problems. And the story of vitamins, I think, is a cautionary tale, because there's so much we don't understand about vitamins, which all of us think that we understand. Well, no one has all the answers. So if you stop and apply that to the rest of food and realize how much we still don't understand about everything else, it seems kind of silly to spend so much time trying to figure out whether the resveratrol in red wine is going to do X or the lycopene in your ketchup is going to do Y. And I just prefer to try to base my diet around the foods that I know seem to have some sort of protective effects and just not worry about all that stuff.
Well, on that note, Catherine Price, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Aarons. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.